Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it.
Yes, I love it too. This is our city, the great city of Chicago. And it will soon be time to pick a new mayor. You've heard from some of the candidates already, but something's changed in the wind since we started doing our candidate profiles. And that, of course, is that the current occupant of the office on the fifth floor of City Hall, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, he ain't running again. So this is an open seat, and that means there will be a new mayor in 2019. So joining me now to talk about his views for the city and what he has planned is the former superintendent of schools, education in our state, and that is Paul Vallis, who went off to New Orleans for a while, and now he's back. And Mr. Vallis, welcome to the podcast.
Well, call me Paul. My father's Mr. Vallis, but thanks so much for the invitation.
All right. Well, I'm Dr. Lisnick, but you can still call me Paul, too. No, I'm kidding.
That's right. I don't want to get confused.
Exactly. Actually, I'm going to start right with that point. When you and I first started talking about this race, Rahm Emanuel was in, and you had to distinguish yourself from YU over Rahm. Let's now start with your reaction to Rahm being out, and I'm going to add one other factor to it. It does look like Tony Preckwinkle might come in this race. We know Gutierrez isn't, so I'm just curious as to why you now with the change in the playing field.
Well, you know, first of all, this was never a race about Rahm. This was a race about who has the vision and the skills and can figure out the means to help the city address its most critical issues: high crime, poor schools, the lack of economic opportunities, the continuing financial crisis. And so for me, it was about running a campaign of ideas or a campaign of solutions. You know, a lot of people say, well, I'm going to embark upon a listening tour. And the great thing is when you have a listening tour, you don't have to answer any questions. Oh, I said, I'm going to have a listening and answering tour. In other words, I want to tell people what I'm going to do to rebuild the police department and to strengthen it and how I'm going to make schools better and how I'm going to what I'm going to do to revitalize the communities on the west side and the south side, which are in depression-like conditions, not recession-like conditions, but depression-like conditions. So at the end of the day, this was about running a campaign of ideas and laying those ideas on the table, laying my specific proposals for addressing the city's critical needs on the table, and then letting those ideas let the vote be a referendum on my ideas.
So let's talk about your ideas as it comes to a variety of areas. So when you were holding important office in Illinois, it was in the world of education. And I imagine that's certainly an area you're going to want to distinguish yourself on from other candidates in the world. Although Toni Preckwinkle, if she comes in, is a former teacher. So you both have the education credential. But let me start by asking you about your vision for schools. You basically said poor schools. Why?
Well, you know, first of all, I think the schools have significantly deteriorated. That doesn't mean there hasn't been academic progress made. But when you have a system where that's lost 70% of its enrollment, I mean, 70,000 of its students since my departure, because the only period of growth in enrollment over the last since 1979, when the school population peaked, were the 6 years that I was superintendent of the district. You know, there were 407,000 students when I came in. There were 439,000 students when I left. And today there's a little over 370,000 students. And when you have a school system with declining enrollment, and let me point out that enrollment is dwarfed by the percentage loss in student population in city colleges. City colleges has lost a third of its students. So you're talking about 100,000 missing students, and people can talk about demographics, the loss of city population, which is another issue. But at the end of the day, clearly, the schools aren't delivering when you see that type of exodus. And the reason we were able to grow from 19, you know, during those 6 years was because we developed budgets that ensured that there was financial stability and continuity. So that all the schools knew that their resources, what resources they're going to have, and that their resources wouldn't be taken away. And they could plan not only for a single year, but they could plan for multiple years. And then what we also did, and that included negotiating a long-term collective bargaining agreement, so we wouldn't be going from one collective bargaining crisis to another. And but it also meant designing budgets that were school investment vehicles. So what I did was, for example, when they wanted to put a new magnet high school on the north side, I put a new magnet high school in every region, in every single region. When I developed a strategy to what I call magnetize the neighborhood schools. The idea was to put high quality exemplary programs in all neighborhood schools. So if for children who were not able to get into magnet schools, for parents who were looking for other educational options, they would be options in their neighborhood schools. So those two things alone made a dramatic difference. And then, of course, we did the most massive building renovation and improvement. I mean, we literally renovated major renovations of over 350 schools, not to mention building 78 new buildings, many of them replacement buildings and additions and annexes. So it was that type of investment and those type of priorities that made a difference. And then, of course, my first budget was a five-year structurally balanced budget. I inherited a district with a projected $1 billion structural deficit, five-year projection, and left the district with $1 billion in cash balances and 13 bond rating upgrades. So having 6 years of stability, of financial stability and predictability, combined with the physical and academic improvement in the schools, resulted in people staying in the district and people moving back into the district. And I think that's the type of approach that I would not only take with the schools, but it's also the type of approach that I would take with the city, because this city is declining. Do you realize that our property values, our property wealth as measured by residential property values has declined 17% since the 2008 recession, where nationally it's up 7.5%. That's like a $60 billion loss of wealth as measured by the value of residential property. And you ask, how could that be when we see, the cranes and the construction going on in the loop and in the 3-4 mile radius outside the loop? You know what it means? It means that in communities on the west side and the south side, there's the loss in value, property value and wealth, has not been 17%. It's been 30, 40, 50, 60, 70%. When you go through Englewood on Halsted Street, I mean, I spent time in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, after the earthquake, working to rebuild that country. And there was more economic activity in Port-au-Prince, Haiti than there was on Halsted Street. I grew up in the Roseland-Pullman area. And so go to the other Michigan Avenue on 113th Street. And half the stores are vacant or boarded up or in effect burnt out. So clearly, the city needs a mayor who understands how to construct a budget that can not only be balanced and not impose more burdensome taxes and fees on taxpayers, but also how to design a budget that will invest in the type of things that make the city more attractive to move to and more attractive to live in.
I do want to take you into the world of economic development and crime, so many other things we have to talk about. Before we leave the schools, I can't leave the topic that, sure, of course, is front page news these days. It's the Marvin Lovett story, who was a pedophile, actually shot and killed by a teenage boy, one of whom apparently, allegedly, he abused. And I'm sure you are aware, Paul, lots of attacks on you with this from your Lori Lightfoot, who's running, people saying that, you haven't responded to it. So I'm going to give you a chance to respond to it, and I'll turn it over to you. Go ahead.
Let me point out that not only did we respond to it, we actually sent the Tribune a 1,200 worded explanation of what we did during our tenure. But let me sum up the Lovett case by saying, first of all, the case of Lovett is a tragic one because it's an example of how an individual can prey on children in a community while perpetuating the image of someone who is dedicated to improving the health and welfare of the community. And let me point out that Lovett apparently was so respected in that community, he was actually the community representative on the local school council. So I just want to point that out. And Lovett at the time,
he was also a pedophile, unfortunately.
That's right. And when Lovett died, the papers almost eulogized him as being this great advocate for children and for children's safety. And it wasn't until the police department, the police department investigated, obviously, the murder and went into his apartment that they found out that he was a pedophile. So the perception in the community was that he was this great community activist. Let me point out that there was Lovett was not an employee for the Chicago Public Schools. He worked in the schools in part, or he did work in a specific school through the United Airlines program. It was a mentoring program. So there was nothing in his background check that in any way raised any flags. And the only time during my tenure that we became aware of Lovett, and incidentally, we have no evidence that anyone ever communicated to us about Lovett, was an anonymous fax that was allegedly sent during the last year of my administration that no one seems to have gotten, because I don't remember it. Pam Zekman doesn't remember it. Mayor Daley's office doesn't remember it. Gary Chico doesn't remember it. But there was an anonymous fax making some accusations that this Lovett guy was a bad guy. And incidentally, that fax doesn't emerge until 12 years after the fact.
Are you saying the fax did not exist, or you don't recall it? Did that fax exist, or you don't know?
Well, all we have is this anonymous fax that two individuals claim that they sent to a bunch of individuals who don't recall ever getting a fax or knowing really anything about Lovett. And we have no proof that we ever received the fax. So at the end of the day, that is it. And incidentally, that fax was not sent until Lovett was already killed. Lovett was already dead. So that fax was sent after he had been killed and after the police began to investigate.
To your knowledge, is there a search on for the fax? Has anybody been able to find it within the CPS records?
Oh, no, that's the fax. That's the fax cited in the Tribune story.
Right.
That there was this anonymous fax, even sent to Pam Zekman, that basically said, you ought to look at this Lovett guy. He's a bad guy. And incidentally, that fax allegedly was sent after he had been killed. This is the fax that was sent while he was, while he was abusing children. This was a fax that was sent after he was killed and after the revelations began to come out about his background. By that time, it's a police investigation. So that's the link. And let me point out, during that period, we have to understand, I set up an elaborate system, a redundant system, to keep children safe. We not only had the police division, we had the school police unit, specialized trained to provide security in the schools, and we also had protocols so that if ever there was an accusation made, we would turn it over to the police. But we had also created an Office of Investigations to specifically investigate accusations that were made about wrongdoing in schools. We created it's called the Office of School and Community Relations, which was an office staffed by administrators and community activists, community leaders, to provide a direct liaison with individual schools, local school councils, and the school's community to deal with issues. And we also had our Office of Crisis Intervention. And this was the office that dispatched personnel at a moment's notice anytime there was a tragedy or a crisis in any individual school. And we also had our 24/7 reporting system, so people could bring complaints, anonymous, whatever, to the school district, and they would be investigated. And our crisis intervention did not only extend to the school day and to the school grounds. If there was a child that was threatened or a victim of tragedy in the community, we would act. I created a crisis fund that paid for the funerals over 100 children, funerals of which I attended. In those days, anytime I got an honorarium, it went into the crisis fund. So we had created this elaborate system of providing interventions, and all those things are non-existent now. So when I get a line from Lori Lightfoot, who has her own explaining to do when she was on the police board, or for that matter, McCarthy, who, talking about the lack of transparency, I just say, you better be careful. People in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
So your reaction to the Tribune investigation, which found a 58-page case manager's report from the CPS Inspector General's office, and the fact there have been $2.7 million in legal settlements tied to what Lovett has done. I mean, so is what you're saying is all of this happened after when he was killed,
right?
You had no notice this stuff was going on.
Yeah, exactly. The bottom line is the only allegation of notice was somehow after the fact, we got some anonymous facts that we didn't respond to, and nobody seems to remember the facts. And let me point out that I used to pull out two dozen school employees every year based on accusations of a variety of nature. And we would pull them out even before the investigations were complete. We would send them, we used to call it Camp Beverly. We would bring them to the central office and have them lick envelopes or do whatever, because the whole idea was, let's get the person out of the school and let's do the investigation. So we were constantly, in fact, they wrote articles about Camp Beverly and the Crisis Fund and all the things that we used to do. The Inspector General does his investigation after we're gone, and that investigation is initiated by Michael Scott, who succeeded Gary Chico as the school board president. I mean, by this time, I'm long gone. And Michael Scott apparently knew Lovett. Lovett apparently lived in Michael Scott's apartment. Michael Scott's brother was on the local school council with Lovett. So he conducts an investigation. When he gets one of those, he gets a letter, a special delivery letter from the individuals, from two individuals from the district long after my departure, and then he conducts the Inspector General's investigation. So the better question is, why didn't they release the results of the investigation? Why did they accept the results of the investigation or reject the results of the investigation? The bottom line is, during our tenure, we set up an elaborate process for a redundant system of protecting children. And you have to remember, at the time, we had 439,000 students and over 50,000 employees and volunteers, including the local school council members, local school councils for 558 schools.
To your knowledge, Paul,
was a massive district.
So at that time, were there any reports of any other, sexual abuse, predator behavior, anything like that?
Yeah, we pulled people out. We pulled people out with regularity. Absolutely. In fact, Marilyn Johnson, who was our chief legal counsel, our corporation counsel, went on to be a judge on the juvenile court, retired judge for 12 years. So the bottom line is, yeah, we were very aggressive. I mean, when we came in the door, we had some cases where we had to pull people out.
So what was your reaction when you did start to
hear all sorts of offenses?
When you started to hear about this then, and again, this is all, today's news many years later, so I understand the frustration with that. What was your reaction to just hearing all of this? I mean, was it immediate defense mode? We didn't know. Was there a sense of, did we know? I mean, what was your reaction to this?
Well, my response is always to overreact, and my response is to overreact to the benefit of kids. Did we know? Did we miss this? So I went through the process of contacting everybody I knew, not only the four or five people who got the facts, allegedly, because we have no, I mean, it's one anonymous fact. And I want people to understand how many anonymous faxes we used to get on a daily basis. You know what I mean? And a lot of times you'd have accusations against principals and teachers and things. And we took those faxes seriously if we got them. But the bottom line is, my procedure was to talk to our director of school and community relations and to talk to our director of our youth outreach offices. These were actually individuals that we would dispatch to the homes, particularly because a lot of times we had kids who were being intimidated by gangs or threatened or bullied. And reaching out to my regional superintendents or to my chief academic officer and my chief of staff, none of who remembered the case, or even talked to my successor, Ernie Duncan, who was actually the superintendent when Michael Scott was the board president. He at the time, Arnie, as I mentioned, I'd be redundant, was my deputy chief of staff.
Okay.
And, we don't recall Lovett. Marilyn vaguely recalls when he was shot, because when he was killed, because it wasn't the community in the initial community response. But the only link to us was somebody made somebody sent an anonymous fax to like five or six people after he got killed the last year of my administration that none of us can recall. And that's basically it. But
my last question on that is, yeah. I understand you don't recall it. My question is, would it have been filed somewhere? That's what I'm wondering. Did anybody, now that it's come to light, gone back and said, see if somebody's got that fax in a file drawer somewhere?
Oh yeah, you know, you won't be able to find it now. I doubt it. I extremely doubt it. You know, I mean, if there was a fax there, would somebody have found it? All I know is when the mayor's office says that they didn't get it, then when I don't think Pam Zekman remembers it, or the former board president in the board office doesn't recall Lovett, let alone getting some anonymous fax. I mean, you have to understand, we get a lot of anonymous fax, but usually what we would do is we would pass it on to the Office of Investigation or to the Office of School and Community Relations. And when a school was named, that would go to the Office of School and Community Relations, and they would go out there, contact the principal, talk to the local school council. Remember, Lovett was on the local school council. So the bottom line is, you know, we did everything right. That now, you know, I am not in any way diminishing, the horror of what Lovett did. But the fact that he was able to, operate with nobody reporting on him or nobody communicating anything until after he was killed. And after it was in the newspaper, when the police department began an investigation, when they went into his house and they found evidence that he was a pedophile. I mean, that was something that happened for us, you know, in effect after the fact.
Okay.
So I thought, you know, there's no foolproof way to keep, you know, to ensure that, you know, people, you know, are, that everyone can be protected. I mean, it's in a system that large, even when you set up a number of vehicles for people to communicate their concerns and to communicate their complaints. You know, one of the things that I've talked about now in this age of social media is, you know, in the old days, we used to have 24/7 hotlines or drop boxes or we used to get faxes. Now you have social media. Now you can create a social media network that will allow people to communicate or to notify and send complaints about, you know, suspected child molesters or aggressive bullying that's going on or students that are getting intimidated or threatened by the gangs. You know, I mean, we went as far during my tenure there as creating our own little witness protection program where if a student was threatened or if a student was put in a situation where they were at risk, I mean, we would find a new school for that student. From time to time, we would assign a security guard, usually from the school, to pick up the student on their way to work and then to drive the student home on their way back from work. And we did that subtly, but I think we did it quite effectively. And so I thought we always erred on the side of protecting our children. And again, I think we had a system in place. You know, it's tragic that no one was able to communicate their suspicions, before he was killed, and that, you know, the only alleged communication the first communication that we received, we actually received after he was killed. I think we always err it on the side of being overly cautious and overly concerned.
All right. Well, I have you, and I appreciate your candor on that. I know there's a lot of people been trying to get comments and statements out of you, so thank you for I didn't interrupt you, so I let you say what you wanted to say on that. Let me turn to economics.
No, that's fine. And I've been responding to anyone who's had a question. Okay. You know, I mean, I didn't recall the case myself, nor did Marilyn Johnson, my corporation counsel, vaguely recalled Lovett getting killed when it was in the newspapers. Yeah. But you know, it's not like he was a household name,
right?
You know, people. In fact,
he is now.
The city. We called the city hall reporters who basically covered, like Roz Rossi, who covered the legendary reporter who covered the education for the Chicago Sun-Times. She didn't remember the case at all, never remembers getting any sort of communication. Okay. So we reached out to about everybody. But by that time, he's not an employee at the school, and it seemed to be, and, you know, and again, that, you know, maybe that lack of an absolute direct connection, had there been more of a direct connection, obviously, you know, we might have been alerted earlier and we could have responded. But the bottom line is we don't get a communication, an alleged communication until after he's dead. And, okay. And that's it. So, you know, so anyone trying to claim that we are insensitive or unresponsive, because we didn't, you know, we didn't respond to an anonymous email that was sent that we don't recall ever getting.
Facts.
When we had all these safeguards in place, I mean, that's just a lot about, that's a lot about political rhetoric.
Right.
And, you know, my opponents, McCarthy has a lot to answer for on Laquan McDonald and other things. And Lightfoot was on the police board long before the Laquan McDonald incident. So I'll compare my record. When I left the Chicago Public Schools, I went to New Orleans to rebuild schools after my tenure in Philadelphia. And then I went to Haiti, and I'm still involved in Haiti, trying to rebuild a school system that was devastated by that, by that earthquake that literally killed 250,000 people. Yeah. Not being responsive to the needs of others has never been a fault of mine.
All right, I do want to turn to economic development because if you're going to give Rahm credit for anything, I think it is that he certainly has the connections to bring the Amazons of the world, whatever, to Chicago to consider it. My question for you is, how will you fit the need in that bill to improve economic development and to have the kind of corporate reach out that Emmanuel, whether you love him or hate him, has?
Well, look, everybody thinks that these companies came to Chicago because Emmanuel did outreach. I'm not suggesting that he didn't or wasn't effective at it. But, you know, the big aggressive efforts to reach out to companies came long before Emmanuel. I mean, he started with Mayor Daley. I mean, you know, the Sister City program and all of his initiatives. But let me point out that what will ultimately, you know, because, look, yes, there are a lot of new corporate headquarters that are located in the city. But, you know, I have to laugh because I don't recall Mayor Daley ever bragging about bringing a corporate headquarters from the suburbs to the city. I mean, he counted those corporate headquarters and had his press releases when people came from out of state. You know, so, you know, bringing jobs from or bringing corporate headquarters from like McDonald's, how many of those individuals who are going to move into that corporate headquarters, that significantly downsized corporate headquarters, are going to actually live in the city and work. Obviously, they're going to be working in the city.
So what will you do?
My point is,
what will you do?
Well, you know, I'm certainly going to be as aggressive as the mayor, as Emmanuel was, and as Daley was, because I really kind of learned from Daley on how to approach these things. So I'm going to be aggressive. I'm going to be cautious about giving away the store in terms of awarding enormous long-term tax breaks and tax benefits, and so you have to have a balance. But let me tell you the danger that the city is experiencing right now. Now, even during this period of growth, the city is still lagging in the big city, the 12 big cities across the country in terms of job growth, even in the area of technology growth. And you have this phenomena in the city where something like 90% of the new housing that has been constructed, they're not residential houses, they're not condominiums, they're apartments. And I think the city has reached kind of a tipping point where I think half the people who live in the city rent, the other half of the people obviously own homes or condos.
Right.
What that means is that people are dating us, but they're not marrying us. So the question is, what is going to be the sustained development? You know, I mean, how are we going to keep people in the city? If people are coming to the city now, are we going to be able to keep them in the city when particularly the millennials, the younger generation, when they start having children, when they start to have to make decisions about were to send their children to school. So I think ultimately being aggressive, look, I'm pro-development, and I'm delighted and thrilled with the development that's going on in this city. And I agree with the mayor when he says the development in the Loop and in the outlying areas is kind of an economic engine that's benefiting the entire city. There's no doubt about it. But what ultimately is going to allow us to have sustainable development and what is going to begin to grow this city, because the city has been in decline in terms of population and in terms of wealth, yeah, is going to be the type of policies that develop the South and the West Side and the type of policies that make all neighborhoods safer, that improve the quality of schools, so that neighborhood school is an option. A lot of people, you know as well as I do, I mean, how schools impact the decision on where you want to live and whether or not you're going to stay in the city or what suburb you're going to pick or what neighborhood you're going to move your, declare a permanent residency. So I think, by having a policy that addresses the city's financial issues without pounding working families and without a whole new series of draconian tax and fee increases that impact those less able to pay, and having a strategy to rebuild the police department, having a strategy that expands high quality school choices in all the communities, all of our neighborhoods, I think those are, that ultimately is going to improve the climate in the city for people who want to move here and for people who have a choice of whether or not to stay here.
I do want to follow up on the crime piece. Obviously, we have to talk about that before I let you go. Yes. One little piece, you gave a compliment to Mayor Daley, Richard M. Daley, in there, and that's okay. My question to you is, would you say Mayor Daley did a better job? And be careful when you answer this, because I have a couple things in mind, depending on your answer.
Okay.
Did Mayor Daley do a better job overall than Rahm Emanuel when it comes to the finances and economic handling of the city?
Well, look, I mean, clearly Emanuel inherited a fiscal situation that was, a city in financial crisis. There was no doubt about it. You also have to remember, though, we were coming out of the 2008 recession, a recession that devastated many a budget across the nation. And so obviously there was a hole to dig yourselves out of. And I'm not saying, I'm not here, I can only speak to my tenure when I was city budget director and revenue director, budget director, and school chief. And in those 12 years, we balanced our budget. We structurally balanced our budget. We held the line on property taxes. We fully funded our pensions.
But that's kind of my question, Paul, because Mayor Daley never did raise taxes. Everybody loved him for that. Our taxes were never going up. But when you say fully funded pensions, I mean, aren't we in the pension crisis and the problem we're in because we never raised taxes at all? And then Rahm gets Rahm ends up supporting the largest tax increase in the history of the city because essentially he said, we got problems here. And let's not forget the parking meter deal.
No, there's no doubt about it. Look, I think what happens is after 2000, after 2001, I think we left the city in the schools in great shape. I mean, who gets 13 bond rating upgrades? If you're underfunding your pensions, you don't get your bond rating upgraded by 13 times. So, so the point is both, I think then the city wasn't in very good shape. And let me point out that when the pension earnings began to slip in terms of their growth, at least with regards to the Chicago Teachers Retirement System, this is in 2004, 3 years after I'm gone, the district actually begins to provide additional funding for the system. So they, because that's the way the formula was intended to work. If the system falls below full funding, based on 30-year projections, you have to start making contributions again. But what happens is that in 2008, the recession hits, and it just pounds earnings. It has a adverse impact on revenues. And I think what the city did during that period is they gambled. Mayor Daley didn't like to raise taxes. In 2008, he didn't want to raise taxes because we were in a deep recession. And in fact, they call it the Great Recession, which for many in the economic sector was a severe depression. And so, so I think he did gamble. So, so He made some financial decisions that were have been appropriately characterized as being unsound.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, and I think he was hoping that, you know, the new Obama administration was coming in and that the city would be the beneficiary of that, you know.
And
they threw a Hail Mary pass with the Olympics, you know. So obviously they gambled. And it's at that time, at that critical time, particularly 2010, when they went to the legislature. This is really important. That 2010 date is really important. They went to the legislature, and they asked the legislature to give them a pension holiday, which meant that at the time when the earnings were really suffering, when we were, you know, barely getting out of the recession, they stopped making payments. It's just not into the Chicago teachers' retirement system, but municipal pension, police, fire, and things like that. And obviously that worsened the situation. But let me tell you what happens. Rahm Emanuel comes in 2011. He waits an entire term before addressing those financial issues. You see, so he takes no action. And he continues the pension holidays. You know, in fact, he tries to get an extension of the pension holiday for the Chicago Teachers Retirement System, and Quinn rejects it. You know, and during those 4 years, the city could have gone to the legislature with an agenda that could have gotten many of the things that the city was able to get, particularly on school funding and teacher retirement system funding in 2017, they could have easily gotten in 2011. And had they done that, they would have saved the school system 1.5, and they would have saved the city and city taxpayers $1.5 billion. So, yes, I mean, they did inherit a mess, but their decision to have from day one to concentrate on reelection rather than making the tough decisions.
That they began
to make in the second year of their second term significantly worsened the situation. You see, and that's the reason. And that's the reason our long-term debt obligations are greater now than they were when Mayor Daley left office.
I do want to ask you about crime while I have you here, because obviously Gary McCarthy, sure, as your opponent, is going to put his hat there. And I'm not asking you to criticize or talk about McCarthy, but my question for you is, what do you have planned to do to improve community police relationships in light of the Laquan McDonald trial, which is going on now, Jason Van Dyke? What is your plan?
Well, you know, and I encourage people to look at ballotsforallchicago.com, because everything that I'm talking about here, I lay out in great detail, and you can find it on my website, particularly on public safety, on economic development, et cetera. And on October 15th, I'm going to be speaking at the City Club, and I'm going to lay out my vision on what it's going to take to fully resolve this pension funding issue and to construct a long-term financial plan that gets the city out of its mess and begins to set priorities.
Well, one quick question there. Let me have a spoiler alert, but just a yes or no. Will your plan include raising taxes?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say that until the 15th. I think the plan will obviously include some revenue increases. I don't want to talk about what they are right now, but I will on the 15th. But I think we have to do three things. All right, so let me give you enough of a preview to say we have to do three things.
Okay.
The first thing we have to do is we really have to have a legislative agenda, because there's money that's being diverted from local governments that we're entitled to, and whoever the next governor is, we need to make sure that we have that agenda so we can stop that diversion. And that diversion is costing the city hundreds of millions of dollars. We also need to be prepared, because let's say, Pritzker become governor, and, you know, he's called for increase in the income tax. And, you know, look, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I mean, we're being taxed to death. But the bottom line here is, if there is an increase in the income tax, we've got to make sure, and they failed to do this twice before, that the local governments are not cut out, because local governments are supposed to receive a small percentage of the income tax revenues. And we got shortchanged in the last two, and that's costing us hundreds of millions of dollars. So the bottom line is, we have to have an agenda. We have to. And secondly, we've got to look at spending. Because you have to understand, think about this for a second. Despite the fact that the number of city employees has declined significantly, the cost of city employment has increased. And in fact, there's more than a third of city employees earn over $100,000 a year. And I'm not begrudging anybody for making a fair salary, but a big part of the reason for that is the fact that we're paying almost uncontrolled overtime expenditures. I mean, in the police department alone, they've spent more than $500 million in overtime in the last 7 or 8 years than what was originally budgeted. So we've got to bring spending under control. And every single major, you know, I have managed and assembled 14 multi-billion dollar budgets as my tenure as a school superintendent, as a city budget director. And I have never met a budget that I have not been able to provide, that I have not been able to identify 5 to 6% savings. So I'm going to be laying out a series of very specific recommendations on what needs to be cut and where economies can be found. And then finally, we do need new revenues, but there may be ways of getting those revenues besides just draconian increases in property taxes. And certainly, you know, I'm not going to support any increases in fees and fines. In fact, what I'd like to do is to revisit and reduce, if not eliminate, some of the more oppressive fines. For example, you know, if you get a vehicle, if you fail to get your vehicle sticker, they can, they could ticket you every day until leap year for your failure to secure that sticker. So clearly some of the fees and fines are really punitive and they're impacting the poorest of the poor. So there needs to be, obviously, I will be presenting a number of ideas, specific ideas on how to enhance our revenues. But if the property values in the poorest areas begin to rise, if we begin to invest in neighborhoods that have been long neglected, in addition to continue to support development in the areas that have thrived, then revenue is going to increase because there's going to be more economic activity. You know, I was able to generate $1 billion in cash balances when I left. You know, not only because we were very conservative in how we spent, but also because that significant increase in student enrollment provided us with significant increases in state and federal revenue. Yeah. So there's no substitution for a budget that supports the type of investments that grow a city and that make a city more attractive.
Well, I was just saying, but one question, of course, the mayor doesn't work on an island, and so I'm sort of curious as well. Some of you guys are more, disruptors than others. You know, you have people like Ed Burke, who had chair the finance committee, and that controls so much and rules, and things go to live and die. Does Ed Burke stay in that role if you're mayor?
Well, you know, I think there needs to be real reforms of the workman's comp system, and I think there's things that can be done to create greater competition and greater transparency when it comes to the management of our healthcare programs. So I believe that there are considerable savings to be had in both. You know, the question.
But do you keep the power structure in place? Do you keep the current?
The question is, do you need to remove an individual or do you need to change the dynamic or the structure? The bottom line is, in my administration, I will be making specific recommendations relative to bringing greater accountability and transparency to not only healthcare and the healthcare programs, but also workman's comp. Whether or not that entails you remove some individual or you change one's jurisdiction is second to the reforms itself. Because, you know, there are a lot of programs out there. You know, the healthcare program isn't under Ed Burke. I mean, there's a lot of waste. The privatization of the public schools, the custodial services, which are costing us an arm and a leg and getting failing rates, isn't under the purview of an individual alderman. So at the end of the day, I will support changes in personnel when those individuals, object to fundamental reforms that are going to save the city money. I believe there are significant savings to be had in workman's comp and savings to be had in healthcare, short of cutting people's benefits. And that will all be part of my budget presentation on October 15th at the City Club.
All right. Paul, you've spent a lot of time with me, and I appreciate it. And as I promised, I let you give the answers you wanted to give because I want listeners to be able to just hear what you have to say. So as a final moment, any closing statement, anything you want to say that you haven't addressed that I didn't ask you about that you want people to know about you?
You know, I just want to say that, you know, campaigns are get down and get dirty, so to speak. You know, I'm going to endeavor to be as specific as possible. When it comes to answering questions about how I'm going to address this problem or that problem. And please take a look at my website, Battles for All Chicago. You know, I have 6 veterans at home and 4 police officers. You know, my dad's only sibling, 36 years in Chicago, 3 decades homicide. Actually worked on the Speck case, the Richard Speck case. Mm-hmm. He passed away a few years ago. But my 2 sons who are in the service are police officers. So the bottom line is, please look at those, you know, please look at the specifics of what I've laid out. But I just want to say this, we're not going to improve the city unless we can get a handle on crime. And I've laid out a very detailed plan on how to do that. And no one else I've been running against to date has laid out a plan on how to get more police on the beat so we can have beat integrity, so we're not moving cops around, so we have the support units that we need. And at the end of the day, I think the plan I have to not only improve the numbers, to bring retired detectives back so we can, you know, have enough quality experienced detectives on cases so that we don't have clearance rates on shootings of only 5% and on murders of over 17%. You know, I think, look, you know, McCarthy was the superintendent that presided over the diminishment of the department. And I'll let the police, I'll let the rank and file police speak to his tenure. But at the end of the day, I've laid out a very, very specific plan on how to make the city safer. And I've been equally specific when talking about what it's going to take to revitalize the West Side and the South Side. Because at the end of the day, if we can address the critical problems in those areas, You know, we're all going to benefit. You know, our taxes go up in part because there's so many neglected, underdeveloped areas that are struggling. Crime increases because we have areas of the city where there are no economic activities. And sometimes the crime, the serious crime, migrates to other communities. So at the end of the day, there's no substitute for developing those communities. And then finally, on October 15th, I will lay out in great detail what I think we need to do to solve the pension funding issue and to bring city finances under control. So I just encourage people to really look at the candidates who not only have the ideas and are giving you specifics, but also candidates who have been in the trenches, who have balanced multi-billion dollar budgets multiple times, who have gotten the bond rating upgrades, who have built over 100 schools, who have achieved multiple bond rating upgrades. Because at the end of the day, there's got to be something in a person's past to give you the confidence that the promises they make will be the promises that they will be able to keep. Thanks for giving me so much time. And I want to thank your listeners for their patience.
Well, I appreciate you. And by the way, it sounds like no matter who gets in this race, Paul Vallis is in it to stay.
I'm definitely in it to stay. And you know, while I'm in it to win it, I want to offer enough ideas out there. So whatever the outcome, hopefully some of these ideas will resonate. And because I'm, you know, I want to offer real solutions. That's why I'm in this race, because I think I can offer solutions. And I can lay out proposals that can be implemented.
Paul Vallis, candidate for mayor of the city of Chicago. Thanks for your candor. Thanks for all the time you give me. You've given me more time than I thought you would. So I appreciate that very, very much.
Thank you.
I wish you luck on the campaign trail. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you so much. Good help.
Thank you, Paul.